Chapter 12. Once again, every seat around the round table in the Heliopolis was occupied. The tiered chamber was lit only by the flames burning in the brazier at the centre of the table, and torches that hung from the golden plinths of the statues. This was only the second time Saul Tarvitz had set foot in the Heliopolis, though he knew he had changed a great deal since the first time he had sat in this brotherhood. Lord Fulgrim stood by the Phoenix Gate, dressed in a purple toga, embroidered with gold thread and emblazoned with a phoenix motif. His long hair was crowned in a wreath of golden leaves, and a new sword with a silver hilt was belted at his side. The Primarch personally welcomed his captains back to the quiet order, and the effect on each warrior as Fulgrim offered his greeting was incredible. Tarvitz still felt the tangible excitement and pleasure that came from being personally acknowledged by such a beautifully perfect warrior. Solomon Demeter of the Second sat opposite him and had given him a quiet nod of acknowledgement when he, Lucius, and Lord Commander Eidolon had passed through the Phoenix Gate. Marius Verosian sat sullenly beside Captain Demeter, and Julius Caesaron laughed and told wild tales of his exploits in fighting the Xenos creatures of the Diasporex, complete with gestures and hand motions to demonstrate a particularly delicious blow. Tarvitz caught the glint of annoyance in Solomon Demeter's eyes as Captain Caesaron described how he and the Primarch had fought their way to the bridge of the hybrid command ship, though Tarvitz had already heard that it had been Captain Demeter's warriors who had the honour of first reaching the bridge. Lord Commander Vespasian sat in the seat next to the Primarchs, and his eyes sparkled with good humour at seeing their safe return from their mission. Tarvitz returned the Lord Commander's smile, though in truth he was weary and glad to be back amongst his brothers, for the experience on murder had been a draining one. The Megarachnid had been a terrible foe, and the raw vigour of the Lunar Wolves was, in its own way, exhausting. He glanced over at Eidolon, remembering the tense standoff between the Lord Commander and Captain Torgadon on the surface of Murder after the Lunar Wolf Speartip had arrived. Though Tarvitz was honour-bound to serve Eidolon, he couldn't deny the satisfaction he had taken from seeing the Lord Commander put in his place by the irrepressible Taric Torgadon. Although Eidolon had later managed to work his way back into the good graces of the War Master, he still smarted from his mistakes on Murder and the insolence Torgadon had shown him. Nor had Lucius come back from the time spent with the Lunar Wolves without scars. A duel in the training cages with Garviel Loken had given him a much-needed lesson in humility and seen his nose broken. Despite the ministrations of the apothecaries, the bone had not set properly, and Lucius's perfect profile was, in his eyes, ruined forever. At last the Phoenix Gate closed, and Fulgrim took his seat at the table, extending his hand towards the brazier. "Brothers," he said, "in the fire I welcome you all back to the Brotherhood of the Phoenix." The assembled warriors mirrored the Primarch's gesture and said, "In the fire we return." "Ah, it is good to see you all again, my sons," said Fulgrim, favouring each of them with a radiant smile that lit up each warrior's soul. "It has been some time since our order met to tell tales of courage and honour, but we are once again whole and set upon the discovery of new wonders in an unknown region of space. Our astropaths can tell us little of the region of space we find ourselves in, but we are not cowed by such mysteries. Rather, we welcome them as a chance to further our pursuit of perfection." Tarvitz saw the fierce excitement in Fulgrim's eyes and felt it transmitted to him like a fire in his blood. Even in his most eloquent moments, the Primarch had never seemed this energized, his entire body looking as though charged with the enjoyment of every word. Our beloved brothers are returned from their peacekeeping duties, and though I know they feared for the glory they would miss while we fought with our brothers in the Iron Hands, they have won laurels of their own and were fortunate enough to fight alongside the War Master's warriors against a vile alien foe. Tarvitz recalled the war on Murder, how there had been little honour in the initial drop to the planet's surface, and the death and frantic nature of the combat against the loathsomely quick mega-arachnid warriors. It had been brutal, intense and bloody work, and many good warriors had met their end beneath its raging, bruised skies. Thanks to Eidolon's mistakes, there had been precious little glory won, until the Lunar Wolves had arrived and brought their strength to bear. Then Sanguinius had come, and Tarvitz smiled as he once again pictured the awesome sight of the War Master and the Lord of the Angels fighting side by side, bestriding the horrific battlefields of murder like gods of war unbound. That had been glorious, and the victories they had gone on to win had redeemed their honour. "Perhaps Lord Commander Eidolon will favour us with a tale of battle," said Vespasian. Tarvitz looked over to his Lord Commander as he stood with a curt bow. "I shall, if you desire to hear it." A chorus of cheers responded in the affirmative, and Eidolon smiled. "As Lord Fulgrim said, we won great glories upon Murder, and I humbly thank you, my lord, for allowing us to go to the rescue of our brothers of the Blood Angels." Tarvitz blinked in surprise at Eidolon's words, for he remembered well the fact that no one had dared use the word rescue at the time, for it had been deemed improper to openly suggest that the Blood Angels had needed rescuing. Reinforcement was the word they had been encouraged to use. "Upon arrival at 1:40:20, it was clear that the master of the 140th expedition, a man named Nathaniel August, had not the vision to command the action. Upon learning of the imminent arrival of the War Master, I led our forces to the surface of Murder to secure landing sites and begin the rescue of the Blood Angels' forces August had unwisely committed in piecemeal actions." Tarvitz had been surprised at Eidolon's earlier words, but was shocked, rigid, at this blatant twisting of the facts. Yes, Nathaniel August had drip-fed his expeditionary forces into a danger zone until they were all gone, but it had been no notion of nobility that had motivated Eidolon's decision to drop onto Murder before the arrival of the Lunar Wolves, rather a desire not to share the glory with the War Master's elite. Eidolon went on to tell of the initial battles and the subsequent destruction of the mega-arachnid, taking great pains to emphasise the Emperor's children's role in the final victory, while minimising the parts played by the Lunar Wolves and the Blood Angels. When he had finished, it was to rapturous applause and pounding of the table, as the assembled warriors lauded the honourable victory and feats of arms of Eidolon's command. Tarvitz looked over to Lucius, to try and discern some reaction to Eidolon's blatant reinvention. But the cool features of his friend were unreadable. "A fine tale," acknowledged Vespasian. "Perhaps later we might hear of the heroism of your warriors." "Perhaps," said Eidolon grudgingly, but Tarvitz already knew that such tales would never be heard in this company. The Lord Commander would never allow anything that might contradict his version of the events on Murder. Fulgrim said, "You do our legion proud, Eidolon, and all your warriors will be lauded for the part they played. The names of your dead will be engraved upon the walls of the processional way beyond the Phoenix Gate."
"You honour us, Lord Fulgrim," said Eidolon, once again taking his seat.
Fulgrim nodded in agreement and said, "Lord Commander Eidolon's courage in the face of adversity is an example to us all, and I urge you to pass on his words to your warriors. However, we are here to plan future glories, for a legion must never rest on its laurels and live off past glories. We must always push onwards towards new challenges and new foes against which we may once again prove our superiority. We find ourselves in a region of space where little is known, and we pierce the darkness with the light of the Emperor. There are worlds here that crave the illumination of imperial truth, and it is our manifest destiny to provide it. We draw near to one such world, and I hereby designate it 28-4, in honor of the conquest to come. We will talk more of what I expect from every one of you later, but for now, enjoy the victory wine! With those words, the Phoenix Gate was flung open, and an army of menials in simple chitons of pale cream entered the Heliopolis, bearing amphorae of rich wine and heaped trays of exotic meats, fresh fruits, soft bread, sweetmeats, and extravagant pastries. Tarvitz watched in amazement as the procession of exquisite food and wine was set out on trestles around the edge of the Heliopolis. It was traditional for the Emperor's children to toast a victory before it was won. Such was the surety of their way of war. But such a lavish feast seemed an excessive display of hubris. He joined the other captains as they made their way over to the trestles and poured a goblet of wine, keeping his gaze averted from Eidolon for fear of revealing his misgivings at his retelling of the war on murder. Lucius moved alongside him, a sly grin creasing his handsome features. "Trust the Lord Commander to put a spin on murder, eh, Saul?" Tarvitz nodded and checked to make sure that no one could overhear his reply.
"It was certainly an interesting take on events."
"Ah, who cares anyway," said Lucius. "If there's glory to be had, better it comes to us than the damn lunar wolves."
"You're just bitter after Locum beat you in the training cages."
Lucius's face darkened and he snapped. "He did not beat me."
"Seems like I remember you flat on your back at the end of it," pointed out Tarvitz.
"He cheated when he punched me," said Lucius. "It was supposed to be an honourable duel of swords. But the next time we cross blades, I will have the best of him."
"Assuming he doesn't learn any new tricks along the way."
"He won't," sneered Lucius. Tarvitz was again struck by the sheer arrogance of the swordsman, feeling the balance of their friendship tipping further away from him. "After all, Locan's a base-born cur, just like the rest of the Lunar Wolves."
"Even the War Master?"
"Well, no, of course not," said Lucius hurriedly. "But the rest of them are little better than Russ's barbarians, uncouth and without the poisoned perfection of our legion. If anything, murder proved our superiority to the Lunar Wolves."
"Our superiority," said a voice.
Tarvitz turned to see Captain Solomon Demeter standing behind them.
"Captain Demeter," said Tarvitz, bowing his head, "it is an honour to see you again. My congratulations on capturing the bridge of the Diasporex command ship."
Solomon smiled and leaned in close.
"My thanks, but I'd keep such sentiments quiet if I were you. I don't think Lord Fulgrim was too pleased the second stole his thunder, but that's by the by. I didn't come over here to hear how wonderful I am."
"Then why did you?" asked Lucius. Solomon ignored the insulting tone of Lucius's question and said,
"I was watching you, Captain Tarvitz, as Eidolon told the tale of murder, and I get the feeling there might be more to it than we heard. I think I'd like to hear your version of what happened, if you take my meaning." "Lord Eidolon described our campaign as he perceived it," said Tarvitz neutrally. "Come on, Saul. You don't mind if I call you Saul, do you?" asked Solomon. "You can be honest with me."
"I'd be honoured," said Tarvitz honestly.
"You and I both know Eidolon's a blowhard," said Solomon,
and Tarvitz was taken aback by his fellow captain's bluntness.
"Lord Commander Eidolon," said Lucius, "is your superior officer. You would do well to remember that."
"I know the chain of command," snapped Solomon, "and as ranking captain, I am your superior officer. You would do well to remember that."
Lucius nodded hurriedly as Solomon continued.
"So, what really happened on murder?"
"Exactly what Lord Commander Eidolon said happened," said Lucius.
"Is that true, Captain Tarvitz?" asked Solomon.
"You dare call me a liar?" demanded Lucius, his hand twitching towards his sword, a weapon forged in the Urals by the Terawatt clan during the Unification Wars. Solomon saw the gesture and turned to face Lucius, squaring his shoulders as though in expectation of a fight. Where Captain Demeter was taller than Lucius, broader in the beam, and undoubtedly stronger, Lucius was the more slender of the pair, and was certainly faster. Tarvitz briefly wondered who would prevail in such a conflict, but was thankful that such a thing would never be tested.
"I remember the first time you came here, Lucius," said Solomon. "I thought you had the makings of a great officer and a fine warrior."
Lucius beamed at being so remembered, until Solomon said, "But I see now that I was wrong. You're nothing but a lickspittle and a sycophant who has failed to grasp the difference between perfection and superiority." Tarvitz could see Lucius's face turn purple with anger, but Solomon wasn't done yet.
"Our legion strives for purity of purpose by modelling itself on the Emperor, beloved by all. But we should not strive to be like unto him, for he is singular and above all others. It's true, our doctrines sometimes make us seem aloof and haughty to others, but there is no purity in pride. Never forget that, Lucius."
"Lesson over."
Lucius nodded curtly, and Tarvitz could see that it was taking all of his self-control not to let his temper get the better of him. The colour drained from his face, and Lucius said,
"Thank you for the lesson, Captain. I only hope I can give you a similar lesson some day."
Solomon smiled, and Lucius bowed curtly and turned on his heel to join Eidolon. Tarvitz tried to hide a smile.
"He won't forget this, you know," he warned.
"Good," said Solomon. "Perhaps he might learn from it."
"I wouldn't count on it," said Tarvitz. "He's not a fast learner."
"But you are, eh?"
"I serve to the best of my abilities."
Solomon laughed.
"You're a tactful one, Saul. I'll give you that. You know I had you down as a career line officer when I first saw you, but now I think you may go on to do great things."
"Thank you, Captain Demeter."
"Solomon. And once this meeting is over, I think you and I should have a talk."
The surface of 28-4 was the most beautiful sight Solomon had ever seen. From orbit, the planet's surface appeared peaceful, the land plentiful, the oceans a clear blue, and the atmosphere flecked with spiral patterns of clouds. Atmospheric readings showed the planet had a breathable atmosphere, untouched by the pollution that chokes so many imperial worlds, turning them into nightmarish visions of an industrial hell, and electromagnetic surveyors reported no signs of intelligent life. Detailed surveys would need to wait for the planet's official compliance, but aside from what looked like the ruins of a long-vanished civilization, the planet appeared to be completely deserted. In short, it was perfect. Four stormbirds had touched down high on the rocky cliffs at the mouth of a wide valley. A majestic range of mountains towered above them, their soaring peaks capped with snow despite the temperate climate. As the gritty dust of their landing dispersed, Fulgrim had led his warriors onto the surface of the next world to be brought into the fold of the Imperium. Solomon stepped down from his stormbird and looked around this new world with great hope, as Julius and Marius disembarked from their aircraft. Lord Fulgrim marched alongside Julius, and Saul Tarvitz followed behind Marius. Astartes spread out to secure the perimeter of the position, but Solomon already knew that such measures weren't necessary. There was no enemy to fight here, no threat to overcome. This world was as good as theirs already. As soon as his auto-senses confirmed that the atmosphere was breathable, he removed his helmet and took a deep breath, closing his eyes at the simple pleasure of breathing air that hadn't been through a multitude of filters and air scrubbers.
"You should keep your helmet on," said Marius. "We don't know for certain that the air is breathable."
"According to my armor's sensors, it's fine."
"The Lord Fulgrim hasn't taken his helmet off yet."
So?
So, you should wait until he does.
I don't need Lord Fulgrim to tell me the air's breathable, Marius, said Solomon. And since when did you become such a worrier?
Marius did not reply, but turned away as the rest of the warriors disembarked from the growling stormbirds. Solomon shook his head and tucked his helmet into the crook of his arm as he strode over the rocks to stand at the edge of the cliffs that overlooked the land far below. Beyond the mountains, the landscape swept out before him in a vast swathe of green. Thick forests blanketed the lower slopes of the mountains, and a startlingly blue river flowed lazily along the bottom of the valley towards a far distant coast. Across the valley, he could see one of the tall ruins the orbital cartographer had indicated rising from a cluster of overgrown ferns. From here, it looked like one half of a great archway, but there was no sign of the structure it had once been part of. From his vantage point, Solomon could see for hundreds of kilometres, the glitter of faraway lakes rippling on the horizon, and wild beasts grazing on the plains far below. The wondrously fertile land of 28-4 undulated into the mist-shrouded distance, and birds circled in the clear sky above. How long had it been since they had seen a world as unspoiled as this? Like many of the Emperor's children, Solomon had grown to manhood on Chemos, a world that knew neither day nor night, thanks to a nebular dust cloud that isolated the planet from its distant suns. A perpetual grey twilight, through which the stars never shone, was all he had known, and his heart leapt to see such a beautiful cloudless sky. It was a shame that the coming of the Imperium would forever change this world, but such change was inevitable, for it was a matter of record that it had been claimed by the 28th Expedition in the name of the Emperor. Within days, Mechanicum pioneer teams and prospecting rigs would descend to the surface to begin the colonization process and exploitation of its natural resources. Solomon knew he was just a simple warrior, but as he looked into the eye of the world, he dearly wished there was some way for mankind to avoid such wanton destruction of the landscape. With the light of science and reason they brought with them, could the Mechanicum not find some way to harness the resources of a planet without bringing the inevitable fallout of such industry, pollution, overcrowding, and the rape of a world's beauty? Such concerns were beyond Solomon, and made no difference to him, for if this planet was as deserted as it appeared, then they would move on soon, leaving a garrison of Lord Commander Fio's Archite Palatines to protect the soon-to-be-developed world of the Imperium. Solomon! Shouted Julius from the side of the Stormbirds. He turned away from the stunning vista and made his way back to the assault craft.
What's up?
Get your men ready, said Julius. We're going down to take a look at that ruin. The interior of La Fenice had changed markedly over the last 2 months, reflected Ostian as he nursed another glass of cheap wine. Where once the place had possessed a faded bohemian chic, it now resembled some monstrously overblown theatre from a more decadent age. Gold leaf covered the walls, and every sculptor on board had been commissioned to produce dozens of pieces for the multitude of newly erected plinths. Almost every sculptor. Artists painted frenziedly, colouring mighty frescoes on the walls and ceiling, and an army of seamstresses worked on the creation of a mighty embroidered theatre curtain. A vast space above the stage had been left for a great work that Serena D'Angelis was supposedly working on, but Ostian had seen nothing of his friend for weeks to verify this fact. The last time he had seen Serena had been over a month ago, and she had looked terrible. A far cry from the fastidious woman he had, if he was honest, begun to fall a little in love with. They had exchanged only a few words of greeting before Serena had hurriedly and clumsily excused herself. "I have to go and see her," he said to himself, as though the act of saying the words aloud would make their realization more likely. A troupe of dancers and singers cavorted on the stage to a cacophonous racket that Ostian hoped wasn't supposed to be music. Coraline Aseneca, the beautiful remembrancer and actress who had denied him the chance to visit the surface of Laren, stood centre stage. The true architect of that misfortune strutted like a martinet before the stage, screaming and yelling at the dancers and choral singers. Bequa Kinska's blue hair waved around her head like alien seaweed, and her dress flailed as she raged at the incompetence of those around her. To Ostian's eye, the effect of what was being done to La Fenice was grotesque, the excess of the design rendering the overall aesthetic into a confused jumble of sensations. At least the bar area was still intact, the crazed interior designers not yet having the courage to try and shift several hundred surly remembrances from their perches for fear of inciting a full-scale riot. A great many of those remembrances gathered around the huge figure of an Astartes named Lucius. The pale-faced warrior regaled his audience with tales of a planet he called Murder, telling improbable tales of the Warmaster and Sanguinius and of his own mighty deeds. Ostian thought it rather wretched that a mighty warrior such as an Astartes should seek so obviously to impress the likes of those that filled La Fenice, but he kept such thoughts to himself. In the past, La Fenice had served as a place of relaxation, but the constant hammering, blaring music and caterwauling from the stage had transformed it into a place where people simply came to complain and curse the fates that had seen them excluded from the process of its renovation.
"You notice it's all the folks that went down to Laren that got to work on this place," said a voice at his elbow.
The speaker was a bad poet by the name of Leopold Cadmus. Ostian had spoken to him on a few occasions, but he had, thankfully, managed to avoid reading any of his poetry. "I had, yes," said Ostian, as a shouting team of labourers tried to guide a lifter servitor in the placement of a libidinous statue of a naked cherub.
"Bloody disgrace is what it is," said Leopold.
"That it is," agreed Ostian, though he wondered what part someone like Leopold had expected to play in the work going on.
"I'd have thought someone like you would have been a definite to do something," said Leopold,
and Ostian couldn't miss the jealous edge to his statement. He shook his head and said,
"I'd have thought so too, but looking at what they're doing to the place, I think I'm well out of it."
"What do you mean?"
slurred Leopold, and Ostian realised the man was drunk. "Well, I mean, look at it," he said, pointing towards the paintings along the nearest wall. "The colours look as though a blind man has chosen them, and as for their subject matter, well, I'd expect some nudes in a theatre, but most of these are virtually pornographic."
"I know," smiled Leopold. "It's wonderful, isn't it?"
Ostian ignored the remark and said,
"Listen to that bloody music. I loved Bequa Kinska's work when I first heard it, but this is like a cat hung up by its tail outside a window and trying to stick to the panes of glass with its claws. As for the sculptures, I don't know where to start. They're crude, obscene, and there's not one of them I'd consider finished."
"Well, you are the expert," said Leopold.
"Yes," said Ostian, shivering, as he remembered hearing that same sentiment recently. It had been an ordinary day, the high-pitched tapping of his hammer and chisel filling the studio as he sought to render his vision into the stone. The statue was slowly coming to life, the armoured body of the warrior taking shape within the marble as Ostian had chipped away all that wasn't part of the form he had seen in his mind. His silver hands roamed the marble, the matriculators within his fingertips reading the stone to unlock the secret fault lines and stress points hidden within its mass. Each stroke of the hammer was finely judged, delivered with an instinctive feel for the shape he was creating, and a love and respect for the marble he worked with. From a slow beginning, where anger had been motivating his hammer blows, a new calmness and respect for his vision had softened his attacks on the marble, and he found the serenity that came with the satisfaction of seeing something beautiful emerge. As he stepped back from the marble, he became aware of a presence within his chaotic studio. He turned to see a giant warrior in purple and gold plate armour, carrying a great golden-bladed halberd. His armour was ornate, much more so than was common for an Astartes. The warrior's helm was winged, and the frontal visor had been fashioned to resemble the countenance of a great bird of prey. Ostian pulled down his dust mask as another 5 identical warriors entered his shuttered studio, followed by a lifter servitor bearing a wide pallet upon which were 3 irregularly shaped objects draped in white cloth. Ostian immediately recognized the warriors as belonging to the Phoenix Guard, the elite Praetorians of... Fulgrim entered his studio, and Ostian was stunned rigid at the towering presence of the Primarch. The master of the Emperor's children wore a simple robe of deepest red, woven with subtle purple and silver threads. His pale features were powdered, his eyes rimmed with copper ink, and his silver hair was pulled back in an elaborate pattern of plaits. Ostian had dropped to his knees and bowed his head. To be in such close proximity to a being of perfect beauty was like nothing Ostian had ever experienced. Yes, he had seen the Primarch of the Emperor's children before, but to be in a confined space and have his dark eyes fixed upon him was akin to being rendered dumb and idiotic in the space of a moment.
"My lord, I..." began Ostian.
"Please stand, Master Delafour," said Fulgrim, walking towards him. Ostian could smell the pungent aroma of the scented oils that had been rubbed into his skin.
"Genius such as yours need never kneel before me."
Ostian slowly rose to his feet and tried to raise his head to look the Primarch in the eye, but found his body unwilling to obey.
"You may look upon me," said Fulgrim.
Ostian suddenly felt as though his muscles were under the control of the Primarch, and his head came up without any apparent command from his brain. Fulgrim's voice was like music, each syllable pronounced with perfect pitch and tone, as though no other sound could have filled the air so appropriately.
"I see your work progresses," said Fulgrim, walking around the shorn block of marble and admiring his work. "I look forward to its completion. Tell me, will it be a representation of any particular warrior?"
Ostian nodded, trying and failing to find the right words to express his thoughts to this magnificent being.
"Who?" asked Fulgrim.
"It is to be the Emperor, beloved of all," said Ostian.
"The Emperor," said Fulgrim. "A fine subject."
"I thought it fitting," said Ostian, "given the perfection of the marble."
Fulgrim nodded as he circled the statue with his eyes closed, running his hands over the marble, much as Ostian had done only moments before.
"You have a rare gift, Master Delafour. You bring such life to the stone. Would that I could do similar."
I'm told that you have a great gift for sculpture, my lord."
Fulgrim smiled and shook his head fractionally.
"I can craft pleasing shapes, yes, but to bring it to life, that is something that frustrates me and with which I would ask your help."
My help?" gasped Ostian. I don't understand."
Fulgrim waved his hand towards the lifter servitor, and one of the Phoenix Guard pulled back the cloths covering the objects on the pallet to reveal 3 statues carved in pale marble. Fulgrim took him by the shoulder and guided him towards the 3 statues. All were of armoured warriors, and by the markings carved on their shoulder guards, each was a company captain.
"I set out to sculpt the likeness of each of my captains," explained Fulgrim. "But as I finished the captain of the 3rd, I began to feel that something was wrong, as though some essential truth was missing."
Ostian looked at the sculptures, seeing the clean lines and exquisite detailing, even down to the perfectly captured expressions of the three captains. Every line of carving was immaculate, and not a single trace of the sculptor's chisel was left upon the marble, as though each image had been pressed from a mould. Even as he appreciated the perfection of the statues, Ostian felt no passion stirring within him, as he would expect to feel from great art. Yes, the sculptures were perfect, but therein lay their flaw, for something of such technical splendour had nothing of the creator in it, no humanity that spoke to the viewer and allowed him a rare glimpse inside the artist's soul.
"They are wonderful," he said at last.
"Do not lie to me, Remembrancer," said Fulgrim, and Ostian heard a curtness in the words that caused him to look up into the Primarch's icy features. Fulgrim stared down at Ostian, and the expression the sculptor saw there chilled him to the bone.
"What would you have me say, my lord?" he asked. "They are perfect."
"I would have the truth," said Fulgrim. "Truth, like surgery, may hurt, but it cures." Ostian struggled to think of words that would not offend the Primarch, for to do so seemed like the basest behaviour imaginable. Who could conceive of giving insult to someone of such beauty? Seeing Ostian's dilemma, Fulgrim placed a reassuring hand on his shoulder and said,
"A good friend who points out mistakes and imperfections and rebukes evil is to be respected, as if he reveals a secret of hidden treasure. I give you leave to speak freely."
The Primarch's words were spoken softly, but they acted like a key to a locked room within Ostian, opening the door to thoughts that he would not have dared give voice to before.
"It's as if they are too perfect," he said, "as though they have been carved with the head rather than the heart."
"Can it be possible for a thing to be too perfect?" asked Fulgrim. "Surely everything that is beautiful and noble is the product of reason and calculation."
"Great art isn't about reason, it's about what comes from the heart," said Ostian. "You can work with all the technical perfection in the galaxy, but if there's no passion, then it is wasted effort."
"There is such a thing as perfection," snapped Fulgrim, "and our purpose for living is to find that perfection and show it forth. Everything that limits us, we have to put aside."
Ostian shook his head, too caught up in his words to notice the Primarch's growing anger.
"No, my lord, for the artist who aims at perfection in everything achieves it in nothing. It is the essence of being human that one does not seek perfection."
"And what of your own work?" asked Fulgrim. "Do you not seek perfection in it?"
"People throw away what they could have by insisting on perfection, which they cannot have, and looking for it where they will never find it," replied Ostian. "Were I to await perfection, my work would never be finished."
"Well, you are the expert," growled Fulgrim.
Ostian suddenly, horribly, became aware of the Primarch's displeasure. Fulgrim's eyes were like gleaming black pearls, the veins on his cheeks pulsing with suppressed anger, and Ostian was filled with terror at the depths of yearning he saw within them. He saw past the Primarch's desire to render beauty in marble or painting to the obsessive compulsion to achieve the impossibility of perfection, a desire that would allow nothing to stand in its way. Too late, Ostian saw that despite asking for honesty, Fulgrim had not wanted honesty. He had wanted validation of his work and honeyed lies to prop up his towering ego.
"My lord," he whispered.
"It is of no matter," said Fulgrim acidly. "I see that I was right to have spoken to you. I shall never lay chisel to marble again, for I am clearly wasting my time."
"No, my lord, that's not what I—"
Fulgrim raised a hand to cut him off and said, "I thank you for your time, Master Delafour, and I will leave you to continue your imperfect work."
Surrounded by his Phoenix Guard, the Primarch of the Emperor's Children had left his studio, leaving Ostian trembling with the horror of seeing inside Fulgrim's head. Ostian shook off the memory of Fulgrim's visit to his studio as he realized that he was being spoken to. He looked up and saw the pale-skinned Astartes looking down at him.
"I am Lucius," said the warrior.
Ostian nodded and drained his glass.
"I know who you are."
Lucius smiled, pleased at the recognition.
"I'm told that you are a friend of Serena D'Angelus. Is that true?"
"I suppose so," said Ostian.
"Then might you direct me to her studio?" asked Lucius.
"Why?"
"I wish her to paint me, of course," smiled Lucius.